So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. Shalynn Lowe is out this week, but joining us is Nathan Ingram, Deputy Editor. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Pretty good, man. How are you this week?
I'm doing okay. I'm super busy. I know you're super busy. That feels like, you know, the story of our times. We joke about Techtober, but it's real. It's real. All those products you see get announced, folks, we have to end up reviewing them and using them, and that all takes a while. So stay tuned. We're going to be chatting about Nate's experience with the new base iPad and the iPad Pro. We talked about like the announcement last week, but now we have like the full review from Nate. So I'm really interested in diving into that. And, you know, we'll see what's going on with Elon Musk and Twitter. Seems like that's actually happening.
One day.
As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. You can drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We often do a live stream around 10 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel. Tune in for that. We may not be doing one next week, but we'll see. We'll see how things go. But yeah, typically put that in your calendar. It's a fun time.
I can confirm it's a fun time, having done a couple myself.
Yeah, it's great. So, Nate, I know you're in iPad hell right now. Broad impressions. iPad and new iPad Pro. I read your previews. Like, I've read your early coverage. It seems like you're into them. It seems like you didn't have the same confusion we did with the base iPad. But what are your thoughts on these things?
So, I think I will address first the confusion aspect because the more I've used it and started to put it into the context of the broader iPad lineup, I will admit I am now a bit more confused.
Okay.
Yeah.
You saw what we were saying because to kind of encapsulate it, there is still the old base iPad, which sells for $329. That's last year's model.
Yep.
There's this new base iPad, which is what, $450?
Yeah.
Yep. And then there's the iPad Air at $599, and then the Pro and yada yada. And oh, the Mini is in there too.
Yep.
I
like that the Mini continues to be its own kind of thing, standing out there on its own though. Like if you want a small one,
yeah, lower the price, please. Like if you're going to do something, give me a cheaper Mini. But both Sherlyn and I were looking at this lineup and saying, what the hell is going on? Because if you're in the market for an iPad, it's kind of unclear what to get. I'm interested in what you think of the new base iPad, Nate, because it is, hey, it's a more powerful entry-level iPad that costs a ton more. I'm sure it's fast, but like, do you think it needs to be that expensive? Like, do you think Apple's on a good track by raising this price?
Yeah, it's interesting. First of all, broadly speaking, when you talk about the like confusion of the lineup, I feel like this happens every few years where the lineup makes sense. They add some things. It starts to fall apart a little, and then they course correct a year or two later. So I wouldn't be surprised if in a year we're saying, okay, this makes a little more sense now. But to get specifically into the new iPad, it's $450, which is $120 more than the one it ostensibly replaces. Oof. And in a vacuum, there are a lot of things that are better about it, right? Like it has a more modern design. It has a more, it has a bigger screen that goes more or less edge to edge. It has USB-C finally. It has stereo speakers in landscape mode, which is nice. The camera is on the landscape edge for the first time, which is great. It has a new keyboard accessory.
So that means if you're holding it on its side, the camera will be on top. That's
right. So if you have it like in a keyboard dock, it'll be facing you the right way instead of off to the side, which to me is like one of the reasons why I never use an iPad for video calling, because it just puts you off to the side.
I mean, I do see people complaining about that. But as somebody who uses an iPad several times a day for video calls, it's not great to have the camera on the portrait side, but it's not the end of the world. It's fine. It's usable.
You know? center stage helps a lot with that, where it like kind of zooms and whatnot. What else do they improve? Obviously, a better processor.
You've got more storage.
No, same storage as last time. 64, 256. That stayed the same. So 450 for this, it cribs a lot of stuff from the iPad Air. Obviously, it looks and feels basically identical. But then you start to get into like the weird catches, as you always do. Naturally, the screen is not as good as the one in the iPad Air or Pro. It still has an air gap, so it's not fully laminated.
Is that something you actually notice, like in your usage, Nate?
I used to notice. I used to notice it more back in the day on older iPads. I've been the ones that I've owned for a long time have had it laminated, and I remember noticing it being better when I did that. But like, you know, going back to this one, it's not a huge deal. It's just something to be aware of. And again, like it's easier to justify it on a $330 iPad. You say, well, you know, whatever.
Sure, fine.
On one that's close to $500, a little less so. But the biggest weird thing about it for me is the Apple Pencil situation. You know, this is the 2015 first generation Apple Pencil, so it's like 7+ years old at this point. And the problem there is that it used to charge by, it has a little lightning jack on one end, and you stick it into the lightning port on your iPad, and it charges directly. And that was goofy and awkward, but it worked. But the new iPad doesn't have a lightning port. It has a USB-C port. So now there's a little adapter. You take your pencil, you put the adapter on the pencil, you plug your USB-C cable into that, and then you plug that into the iPad or a power brick. And it's like,
I love progress.
It's four pieces to do this simple act of charging. And the problem is that Apple solved this in 2018 when they made the second generation pencil with the magnetic attachment for charging and storage. It stays on the flat top edge of the iPad.
Right.
And now that this iPad has a top flat edge, you could conceivably put the pencil there, but you can't. So my first big takeaway here is if you care about drawing, get the iPad Air or a Pro. It's a much better experience. And it'll last you longer. And that's when, again, the pricing starts to become problematic too, because the new iPad is $450, the Air is $600. So for $150, you're getting a better processor with the M1, a better pencil experience, and a better screen. And to me, all those things sound worth the $150.
Sure.
I don't know how you feel
about that. That's not much. I mean, we used to spend $150 just to get a little more RAM in our machines, you know? So for that trade-off, sure. I would say always get the Air. My thing, just looking at this base iPad, is like, who is this for? You know, because when it was $329, I could be like, hey, you want a tablet? Just get that. Just get that iPad.
It'll run tons of good software. It's fast. Yeah. It'll last for years.
Put it in a case. It's great with kids. It can run a lot. Yeah, it's fast enough. It could do video calls. It could do streaming apps. As it approaches $500, I'm like, wait a minute. I can't just say, hey, the base iPad is a nice, kid-friendly, easy to use or easy to you know, buy tablet. Now it starts to seem expensive.
And Apple seems to be admitting that by keeping the $330 model around, right?
Sure. For now, too. That feels like a concession. That feels like, okay, it's here for now. But, you know, next year, 2 years from now, who knows? Like, I'm sure they can't wait to raise that base price.
I mean, yeah. And I feel like even if they priced it at $399, you know, it would be like, okay, it's cheap enough that it makes sense and is differentiated from the Air enough, but it still is like somewhat of a good deal, right? Like, cause like I said at the top, I was like, well, there are a lot of improvements here that make it better than the $330 one. So I understand it costing more, but there's some degree, you know, when I was thinking about Apple again, broadly, they do occasionally have good value products like the $330 iPad, the iPhone SE, the Apple Watch SE, like all those are pretty reasonably priced, you know, pretty capable. But generally speaking, I think we're like a frog in the pot being slowly boiled by higher prices for like anything you actually want to own. And that's what this feels like a little bit to me.
Yeah. And the mini, by the way, the iPad mini is still $499. Occasionally we see it on sale. I would love to have that thing on sale. Have you played much with that? Like, would you recommend like, hey, that's another option within this vague price range. Is the mini a good option for somebody who maybe just wants a machine for like ebooks and light browsing around the web? You know, something like
that? Yeah, I unfortunately didn't review the new mini last year because I was reviewing the other iPad. So we passed it on to Valentina. But I think that people like the mini, people who like the mini really like it, you know? And like, I definitely kind of miss something being that easy and light to hold in your hand. It's really nice. You're paying a little extra, but it uses the second generation Apple Pencil. The screen is laminated and has the anti-reflective coating. So that one's like a little bit more of a, that one has always been a little more premium than the 331, right? It's not just a smaller cheap iPad. Like it's a nice,
it's more like a
device.
Smaller Air basically.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yep. And so I say that if you don't care about typing so much, then yeah, that's a good one. But actually let's talk about typing. Let's talk about this new keyboard too.
Very expensive keyboard too.
So expensive. I mean, that's again, the highlight is that for $450, You get the base, you get the iPad. The keyboard is an extra $250. So we're talking $700. Yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot. And they did this with the Pro keyboards too, that Magic keyboard with the like magnetic cantilevered whatever. And like it's crazy. That's what I'm talking about being boiled, right? Because you know, it used to be you could get a decent iPad keyboard from Apple for like $150 or like $170, and now it's $250 or $300 or $350, and it's just like it's a lot of money. So this iPad kit that Apple sent me was $700 for the iPad and the keyboard, plus another $100 for the pencil. So $800. So we're like into like laptop territory.
I mean, basically, or Surface territory, I guess, too. Like, maybe they're more positioning. That's kind of how I saw the Air and certainly the Pro.
Yes.
As sort of like these Surface competitors. But now they're kind of even doing to the base, and that doesn't make sense. There are alternative keyboards, right, from Logitech
Absolutely,
and other companies.
Yes.
So that's a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But I will say, and again, in a vacuum, this new keyboard has a few nice things going for it. Because it's the keyboard deck is the full width of the iPad, so there's room for a function key row. So there's an escape key and volume buttons and media controls. And, you know, the Apple hasn't made a keyboard with those for the iPad before.
Yeah, so something the MacBook Pros haven't had in a while until the M1s, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So that's good. And the trackpad's actually, again, it's a little bit bigger than the one on the keyboard meant for the iPad Air and Pro because of, again, there's more space because of its design. The downside is I don't love keyboard folios personally because of the kickstand. Extending it just doesn't make for a great lap experience because the kickstand is what's resting on like your knees or your legs, and it's just a little funky. But like it's definitely not, it doesn't not work, it's just not as comfortable as the Magic keyboard for the Pro
or
as
stable, I guess, too. Like that's the ultimate thing. Like I am currently reviewing the Surface Pro 9 with 5G, and it's another Surface, and Microsoft is the ones that kicked off that trend of like just put the kickstand on your lap and live with it, deal with it, folks.
It's been 10 years, right? We've been covering how this is like not an ideal way to work for 10 years. I remember
I will talk more about that soon, like later
I remember
in this episode.
Microsoft at some event, you know, trying to like sell the tech crowd, like MacBook Airs, you should get a Surface instead. And it's like, yeah, we're all sitting here typing on our laps comfortably, whereas with a Surface, we might be like dropping it.
With a Surface, you have to hold things your leg a certain way.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I feel like is both overblown, but worth knowing about. Because it's not like you can't do it. I use the new iPad on my lap plenty. It's just not as good.
Yeah, I don't think it's overblown if it becomes a problem, like, after a while. Is there, I haven't taken a close look at the iPad Pro folios. Are those a little more stable? Like, those are bottom, right?
Yeah, it's a flat bottom, like a laptop. The reason why there's not as much room on it is because, like, the screen of the iPad extends out from there and kind of, like, covers up some of the keyboard deck. So, like, I think that's why there wasn't a row of function keys previously. But, you know, we'll see what they do. We'll talk more about the Pro in a minute, obviously. But, yeah. It's definitely more stable. That I use on my lap comfortably all the time. I personally own an 11-inch iPad Pro, which I love because it's got
Which year?
It's from 2020, so it's pre-M1, unfortunately. But I just installed iPad OS 16 on it. It runs great. Stage Manager works on it. So, yeah, we'll talk about Stage Manager more in a bit, too. Yeah, there's a lot to go over with these, surprisingly so.
There is. So, looking at the base iPad Air or the base iPad now, who is this computer for? Like, that's the thing, because you just talked about, hey, if you want to draw, if you want to really use the pencil, you should probably at least get the Air, you know. If you're if you're looking for something for your kids, or maybe a gift for a grandparent or something, like somebody who doesn't need to demand too much from their tablets, I feel like the old base iPad is fine, will be fine for years. So who the heck is this one for?
It's for the people who want an Air but don't want to spend as much money. And so I think that it'd be one thing if they just got rid of the old iPad and like this is the new one, and you'd be like, well, like that would be a bold move to be like, screw it, we're staking our claim that this is worth the extra cash, which again, in a vacuum, I think it is, but it's awkwardly placed between those two products. And my hope is that Apple does not solve this by making the Air more expensive. My hope is that they do that in a year, this iPad is at least $50 cheaper.
Oh man, it's tough to talk pricing with Apple because it feels like whenever we get a decently priced product, it is like a gift. It is a benevolent gift from Apple. They can take it away at any point. If the product doesn't do well, you know, it's just gone. They will not stick with it because they care more about average sales price than, you know, making consumers happy. Yeah.
Lost in all the talk about the iPhone Mini and them transitioning to an iPhone Plus again is the fact that the Mini was $100 cheaper. So like that was a pretty relatively affordable way to get the latest iPhone tech without spending $800, right? I think it was $700, and now it's $800 and $900 for the two iPhone 14s. So yeah.
Because people want bigger screens too. Like it's there's a lot that goes into it. But sure. Okay, base iPad. You like the speeds? Or you like the improvements?
It's quite responsive.
Yeah, if you can, I mean, stomach the price increase, right?
Right. I think I would say that like if you have the disposable cash, this iPad will get you further than the base, the $330 one. But you should be aware of the quirks and sort of what you could get for a little more money if you saved for an Air.
Yeah. I guess we need to start classifying like iPad users into like the really casual folks, the people who just need to book around a tablet, maybe the folks who want to be a little more serious, like the folks who want to do some typing, want to do some drawing. I feel like that's what the Air is for. And then there's the Pro for like the really, really heavy users. But I presented this question last week. Yep. I'm beginning to think that the Pro is also a machine where I'm like, who needs an M2 chip in a tablet? Like, what are you doing in this? Like, you cannot multitask as much as you could on Mac OS. I'm sure, like, you can do some with iPad OS, and Stage Manager makes that nicer. But I don't see the logic in spending the same amount of money you would on a MacBook Air or close to a MacBook Pro on a freaking tablet. So where do you stand with the new iPad Pro? Because I this kind of a lot of these things get my goat. It's like me versus Chromebooks too. It's like, okay, fine, cheap Chromebooks, totally fine. Sure. I get it. Expensive Chromebooks, what the hell are you doing? Like, this is bad for consumers. What do you think about the new Pro?
Yeah, that is fair. You know, again, my top line thought is, well, it costs the same. It's very expensive. The 11-inch starts at $800. The 13-inch or 12.9 starts at $1,100. So right off the bat, we know we're talking about very expensive devices. Mm-hmm. That's without keyboards or pencils or anything. The good news is that they didn't increase the price. So it's kind of a why not drop the M2 is my thought, right?
We have like, the hardware, sure. Yeah.
Right. And I think that for the iPad Pro line, that's been, you know, Apple knows there's nobody making tablets close to as powerful as this. And they're like, we're just going to continue to like flex our muscle on this and just like get crazy with it. And I will admit, the demos that they showed me in a briefing were pretty bonkers. I'm not a video renderer or special effects guy, so I can't say to what extent, you know, this is meaningful compared to like doing these things on a laptop, but it's very impressive what it can do in terms of like automatically rendering 4K video and like doing these effects across like an entire like 10-minute film like in seconds. Like, it's crazy stuff. So like, but we know the M2 is super powerful, right? The question is like, who can take advantage of this power? And the answer is mostly not a lot of people. Like, I believe to some extent that there's a market for this out there because companies are making these apps that take advantage of it, even if it's kind of limited in scope. I'd love to know the breakdown on sales for the iPad Pro. And I'd also love to know how many people are just people who want a nice device. You know, that's part of it.
They want the most expensive device around. It's like the Apple Watch Ultra problems. Like, most of those consumers are not going to be diving deep into the ocean or hiking into the forest with that. They just want the nicest Apple Watch.
Right. I believe that the Apple Watch Ultra is meeting a need. But again, like, I want to know what percentage of people who buy it are going to use those features, right?
Yeah.
It's an interesting question.
But Apple will never tell us. Yeah.
Right. But putting all that conjecture aside, you know, this is really much, very much just kind of like a speed bump, right? Like, they do, you know, most companies do this with their laptops or whatever every year. And that's what this is. The display, I mean, I will say that for an $1,100 device, I've been reviewing the 12.9-inch model. At least it feels like it's worth that much because I continue to be sort of impressed by the fact they can get the power and capability of a chip like the M2 into such a small device. And the screen was changed when it was updated in 2021 to the, you know, XDR display, with like 2,000 plus local dimming zones and a million to one contrast. Like, it's a wonderful, wonderful screen.
Super
it's
bright,
really
great for HDR type stuff.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, you're getting a great experience there. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I bought the 11 inch because I, you know, a couple of years ago, because I specifically wanted a really nice screen. They hadn't updated the iPad Air yet. I wanted the good keyboard, and I wanted it to be portable, so I went with the 11 inch versus the 13. So I'm like, if I need that much screen real estate, I'm just going to use a laptop.
For sure. By the way, like, how much 13 inch iPad Pro? Did you review the 13 inch or the 11 inch?
I'm reviewing the 13.
You're reviewing
the
13.
You want to talk about prices?
Let's talk about weight too, because I feel like that's part of the practicality you're talking about. You went for the 11 inch because you wanted, you know, a light machine that you could slap a keyboard on. That's probably lighter than a MacBook Air, I assume, like all told. The 13 inch iPad Pro plus a keyboard, how much does that weigh? Doesn't that weigh more than the current Air?
I'd say so. Yeah, I think it's close to. So the iPad itself is a pound and a half.
Yeah,
and then the keyboard is not light because it's very it's really solidly built and it's got these magnets and, you know, it's like, again, it exudes quality, but at the expense of weight. So yeah, I'd say a 13 inch iPad plus the keyboard is coming in close to MacBook Pro territory.
Actually,
probably less.
Yeah, yeah. We looked this up last time like we saw the Pro come up. So yeah, I think even last year, the Pro 13 plus a keyboard was heavier than the M1 MacBook Air. So again, that is a question. So let's talk about price. Like you're saying, you get the 1100 Pro. How much is the keyboard?
Keyboard is $350.
How much RAM does that machine have?
16 gig. Well, so it depends on. So this is interesting, actually, that you ask. So for a long time, Apple didn't even say, right? You could figure it out with benchmarks. Yeah. But now they're saying that if you buy it with less than a terabyte of storage, it has 8 gigabytes. But if you spring for the 1 terabyte or 2 terabyte models, so much space, then it has 16 gigs. So the model that I've been reviewing is a $2,000 iPad with a terabyte of storage and 16 gigabytes of RAM and an M2 chip.
Stop the madness. Stop the madness. To me,
then you add in another $470 or $80 to the accessories. And it's like, this is the most bonkers iPad ever. I feel weird carrying it around, to be honest. but it's super nice. It's so fast. The screen is so nice. But yeah, again, it comes down to like, I want to know more about the people who use this thing for the capabilities that Apple shows off. Because again, there must be some market for it. Otherwise they wouldn't still be selling it in at this price point.
For sure.
And the developers wouldn't be making these apps either, right?
Are there a lot of apps coming in?
So the two that they highlighted in the briefing was DaVinci Resolve and Octane X, both having iPad releases. Which, like, again, this isn't my area of expertise, but it sounds like those are like both super powerful apps and like widely used in the sort of like special effects slash film milieu. So
I feel like people doing work with that too would be like, okay, I want an M2 machine that could do a little bit of work. I feel like you're still better off with the MacBook Air price wise.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know.
Or if you're going to spend, if you're thinking about $2,000, then you can get the M1 Pro, 14 inch model with a great screen. It's very interesting. And you know, again, going back to like the pricing and the weird divisions Apple makes in its lineup, right? They still sell that MacBook Pro 13 with an M2 and the friggin' touch bar. You know, if you want the 14 inch, it starts at $1,999. So like they're effectively pricing normal consumers out of the MacBook Pro at this point, because the 13 is not recommended over the Air, and the 14 starts at $2,000.
Yeah. I mean, that's that was pretty much my review of the M2. MacBook Pro is, I called it Pro in name only because, it's faster, I guess, except the Air has a bigger screen now and a like more modern design and just feels, every time I hold this new Air, I'm like, oh, this feels nice. This feels this feels like the future of computing right here.
I haven't checked one out, but I really want to get my hands on one.
Yeah, next time you go to Best Buy, I think you could just like stroll by and see like how it feels. But it's insane. It's impressive. Yeah. But you do like the speed increases in the iPad Pro. For somebody looking for a Pro tablet, I feel like it's either this or a Surface Pro, right?
Yeah, definitely.
They're kind of comparable price-wise and sort of power-wise. I don't, that's a whole thing. And I'll be talking more about that. Right. But yeah, any other thoughts on the iPad Pro at this point?
Yeah. So like I said, it's a spec update year, right? Mm-hmm. M1 to M2. Basically everything else is the same. They added the Apple Pencil Hover, which is kind of neat. So if you're within 12 millimeters of the screen, UI elements will interact with the pencil. So, mm-hmm. you know, a really easy to explain one is that if you hover over like app icons in the dock, the one you're over will grow in size. So that's just like a little trick. But if you're in the Notes app and using a watercolor brush, you know, it'll show you a preview of the color before it goes down on the page. Mm-hmm. And if you switch to a different color, it'll show you a preview of how they'll mix together, for example. That's kind of cool. And like, I could see that style of thing being useful. Another one is in Pixelmator Photo. If you go to the, you know, if you load up an image and there's the filters at the bottom, you can run the pencil along them and it'll show you a preview with that filter right. applied instantly. Right. And obviously the thing is so fast that it just happens instantly. So that'll be kind of fun. I'll be curious to see how developers take advantage of that. You know, it has Wi-Fi 6E, which is great if you've got 6E set up. It's got 5G naturally. I was on the train this morning and I was pulling in some pretty crazy speeds using that with, I was getting ultra wideband and that was pretty nice. Although
which network?
The one that I'm testing is on Verizon.
Okay. That's cool. That sounds like a nice, easy experience. Better than I'm having with my Surface Pro 9 5G here, which so clunky. My review.
Are you gonna talk about that next week?
You know what? We could talk about that now, just because that is kind of a comparable machine, right? It is another machine with an ARM-based processor. Mm-hmm. It has Microsoft's new custom SQ3 chip. Has built-in 5G. It is supposed to be another mobile powerhouse, or certainly their competitor to the iPad Pro. And I'm just looking at this thing like, oh man, you can run some like x86 and x64 apps, older mm-hmm. Windows apps, which that was an update they added to Windows 11 recently. So when the Surface Pro X launched, that ARM chip couldn't run older, like certain older apps. It could run 32-bit, but not 64-bit. It all gets
confusing.
Was
that 2 years ago?
That was 2 years ago. Okay. Last year, they added full X64 support emulation. The thing is, Microsoft's emulation stinks, and their chips just aren't as good when it comes to doing stuff like the Rosetta 2 emulation on the M1 and M2 Mac. Mm-hmm. So what you're left with is a computer that costs more than the Surface Pro 9 with the Intel chip, which is certainly faster because it's a nice 12th-gen chip. It costs $300 more. It is slower. The 5G stuff, less compatible. The 5G stuff, I tried like an eSIM, you know, subscription that I could buy from within Windows. It was fine, but it was super clunky to like subscribe to it. I could plug in my Verizon SIM and that was fine, but you know, it's not as seamless as the whole process seems to be on an iPad. And I think I'm just tired of Surfaces and all the problems around Surfaces. And Microsoft just keeps giving us more problems and pretending it's the future. I don't know. Maybe I'm just grumpy at this point, Nate. I'd love to see you play with this thing. Yeah.
I'm curious too. And I think that's one thing that Apple simultaneously gets flack for, but also it's probably the right mm-hmm. decision, is like making the iPad its own thing. They don't have to worry about legacy compatibility with older apps. It's just like all these developers are making apps for it. They run really well. You know, at this point, it's got enough software out there that you can do what you want with it.
And they solved the app compatibility problem on their computers, like in serious ways. Like, hey, we know this is a problem, but we're going to move to these new chips. And the emulation is faster than a lot of Intel chips we saw up until that point.
Off the bat, too. Like when they released, that's one thing I have to give Apple credit for. They did it right with mm-hmm. the transition to the M1. And they did it right 15 years ago when they went from, G3, G4, G5 to the Intel chips.
Yep.
They had that emulation like out of the box, ready to go. And I hate to use this phrase, but it just worked.
It just worked. I was working in IT at the time and I was afraid of like, man, what is this going to mean for a lot of people? And everything just kind of worked. The older, really old Mac drivers just stopped being supported. Yeah. It was like Mac OS 9 stuff people were still using. But by that point, sure, move on.
That was quite old at that point.
People may not remember this, but the MacBook Pro came about because of that Intel transition. Like the MacBook Pro didn't exist before Apple moved over to Intel.
It was the PowerBook G4.
Yes.
And everybody was like, when will there be a G5 PowerBook? Because the G5, they couldn't get it cool enough or small enough to run on a laptop, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about where things could go for Apple. There was a rumor floating around yesterday about Apple working on a 16-inch iPad for next year. This is from The Information. We've also seen some rumors. I remember seeing like 14 and 15 inch rumors as well. From your perspective, do you think this could happen, and why would it happen? Because we're just talking about like how impractical a 13 inch iPad Pro kind of is too. What do you think, Nate?
I have a hard time with this one because, again, it's a little bit outside of my lane in terms of what I use a computer for. When I think about a giant iPad like that, I think a little bit about, say, the Surface Studio, which has a very, like, it has a design built for, like, getting the screen down, doing, like, major drafting on it. And I could see a theoretical iPad Pro with that size, you know, being used for that. But again, like, how much is it going to cost? How niche? I mean, I just feel like the audience for that is going to be incredibly niche, because a 13-inch iPad is bordering on too big to just, like, use as a tablet in your hands.
You,
like, can't. Sit on the couch.
You don't want to just hold it up. No. Like,
if I want to just hold the tablet, that's when I go for the 11.
Yeah. When I talk about, like, the Surface Pros, it's the same thing. It's a 13-inch tablet. I'm not gonna be lounging with this thing. Yeah.
Well, it's the same way that I completely think that convertibles, where you can flip the screen around, are, like, pointless. Because I'm like, I don't want to use a 3-pound tablet with a 13-inch screen. I want to use a 1-pound iPad.
You want to use a 1-pound iPad. I mean, the point there is more like, you're laying in bed and you're like, just give me a screen. Give me all screen. And I kind of, I've always liked convertibles for that. Although there's certainly other ways, like the Surface Studio laptop, which kind of came and went, and Microsoft, again, kind of botched that launch by giving the quad core chip last year. Freaking, I don't know why they keep doing this. But stuff like that, the HP Folio, which was the leather laptop that, you know, could kind of, you could pull it forward over the keyboard, like that sort of stuff. Those are big machines. But when I'm, especially when I'm like traveling and stuff, and you're sitting in a hotel room, like, a TV is too far away. I want like a nice big screen in front of me or something. I just kind of want to lounge. I find that to be good. But yeah, an iPad.
13 is the outside, as big as you can get with that, in my opinion. So, like, I don't know. I'm sure they've tried it. I'm sure they've tested it. I don't see it as a consumer product. I just don't quite buy it.
I mean, that's the way I felt about the iPad Pro in general for years, and I still kind of feel that way. So I don't know. People, if Apple produces something, people will buy it. People are buying those $1,000 wheels for the for the old Mac Pro, I think. So that's a thing. I'd imagine working. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say one thing before we move off of the Pro. Important part of that, like we said, is Stage Manager. And there's been a lot of talk about Stage Manager on the iPad. I'm probably going to botch his name, but Federico Vitici at Mac Stories, he does excellent reviews of iPadOS and iOS, and he writes, you know, very lengthy, extensive stuff. He's a big iPad. He loves it. He uses it for all his work, I get the sense. He is so mad about Stage Manager because UI inconsistency, crashes, and that sort of thing. It sounds like he just had a really bad time of it, and I believe him because he tests this stuff really extensively. I will say the good news for me is that on this new device, with the final version, the non-beta software, I haven't run into crashes. There's still some weird inconsistencies around, like, what's the best way to launch an app, and is the strip on the left showing up, and that sort of thing, right? So it's not perfect. You can tell it's new. It's having growing pains. But from a stability standpoint, I think that it's much better than it was when the software was in beta. And, you know, I spent a few times just working solely on the iPad Pro for like an entire day doing all of my work with it. And I found some ways with Stage Manager to make a better multitasking setup than I used to be able to do on an iPad. So I'd say if you are going to get this iPad or have one that supports Stage Manager, take a few days to like mess around with it. See if you can find a way to set it up in a way that is pleasing for you.
It's different. I can imagine somebody actually using their iPad as their full-time machine. I imagine they had to make some compromises to kind of live like that. So, you know, I could see that being a problem. Have you used Stage Manager on Mac, on your Mac?
I have not yet. I have not had a chance to update to Ventura, and I didn't try the beta this year. So I'll probably do that like this weekend or whatever. But I think that like one of the main things that I was reading about it being problematic was that window resizing and moving on the iPad isn't it tries to help you. So like it'll move the windows a little bit and like snap to certain sizes. And
it
that
just
sort
centers
of thing.
Everything. So like
whereas like on a Mac, you can still like I think I'm assuming you still have the full pixel control to make them the size you want and the place you want, Right.
You do, although stage manager tends to like, it still takes more control on a Mac. But what I find interesting is I've been running it on my Air, and I did the preview. It is really great when you want to do focused work. Like that is the main thing. Like if I just want to sit and stare at Evernote or something and just like work on that stuff, and then maybe I need to hop over to Slack to like answer some messages. It is better than creating a whole other desktop environment, which you can do. You can create a, like a virtual space. I always found moving back and forth between those things kind of annoying and kind of bad. Where otherwise on a Mac, like you have to minimize everything and have one window open. It just felt, like my workflow was never quite, I could never actually hit a good flow on Macs, where Stage Manager kind of makes that happen. You know, but you have to get used to it. Yeah.
I've used spaces or, you know, virtual desks on the Mac for a long time, and I'll often throw an app into full screen when I want to focus on it. But I'll be curious to try this new method. And that might be why Stage Manager on the iPad worked for me, because I've been using the concept of like make a space, put the two or three apps that you want in there that kind of relate to each other. Like I'll have, you know, a document for drafting text, and then a browser window with all the tabs relating to the subject next to it. And then I'll have another space where I've got like messages in Slack, for example, and that sort of thing. So I just use that mindset when I was doing Stage Manager. And then if there's something I really wanted to focus in on, I would just run that one app, you know, on its own or run it full screen or whatever.
It's you know what? It's a new thing. I feel like Mac users in general hate change. So it is always interesting to see like how Apple kind of balances that stuff out. Anything else you want to mention about the new iPads, Nate? Because I feel like we're going to have to wrap up. We have some news to talk about. But the iPads, it does seem like a very standard upgrade on the Pro side. On the base side, it's a big upgrade, but it's a confusing one price-wise. Kind of leaves me in a place where I don't know what to recommend to anybody at this point. Depends on what you
Air,
need, right?
Just recommend the Air. Or if it's like, or if it's a grandma situation, then recommend the 331. Yeah. I was going to say also with the Pro, the reason maybe not to upgrade now unless you use it for production and really want that extra speed is I feel like they're going to do a more comprehensive update soon instead of just a chip swap. This basic hardware design has been in play for 4 years now. It'll be, you know, 5+ before they launch a new one. So I don't know what they're going to do. The design is still great. Like I said, it feels great. It's small. It's light. It's got a wonderful screen. But, you know, for example, the new iPad has the landscape-oriented camera, which is nice. The iPad Pro does not, presumably because they didn't move anything around inside. Yeah, they just swapped the chip. Yeah. So I think at some point you're going to see a more robust redesign that'll include things like a better camera placement and, you know, possibly some other tricks that I can't begin to imagine yet.
Again, like, it's so thin. It is so thin. They've already packed so much into it. I don't know what else they could do. They took away our headphone jacks, so it's like, at this point, you're taking away features to add thinness. I guess we will see. But you know what, folks? Let us know what you think about these new iPads and what you're looking forward to with whatever is coming next. Email us at podcast@engadget.com.
Let us know if you believe a 16-inch iPad is on the way.
Or a foldable or something.
Ooh, now we're talking.
Let's move on to some other news. And I feel like the big thing that's just happening as we are wrapping up this episode is it does look like Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter is actually going to happen tomorrow, October 28th. So probably the day you're hearing this. This has been a long and very confusing journey because it started out as a real offer, kind of a joke offer, and then Musk trying to renege. And now basically I think he was basically forced by the court to be like, hey, you got to do this or you got to pay all sorts of fees or who knows, Twitter could possibly sue him. Right. So it seems like he's just moving forward with it. There is some news around that. He has said dumb things like saying he wanted to maybe lay off 75% of the staff to save money and stuff. Employees called that reckless at the time. Earlier this week, he was just like, yeah, that's not happening. Also, that would be a very dumb thing to do, right? To buy a company and then kill most of its staff unless you want that company to die. Yesterday, he had a bit of a PR stunt where he brought a sink into the office. And that's what people are talking about. And just kind of stalked the office and I think frightened the people who were actually working there. Today, he issued a letter to Twitter advertisers, which is does not feel like a thing he actually wrote, but it is interesting to hear some of his reasoning, maybe like the thing he dictated to an intern while he was on the toilet. one thing is He says, the reason I acquired Twitter is because it is important to the future of civilization to have a common digital town square where a wide range of beliefs can be debated in a healthy manner without resorting to violence. There's currently the great danger. There's currently great danger that social media will splinter into far right-wing and far left-wing echo chambers that generate more hate and divide our society. I'm just going to stop reading this thing right now. It is certainly a position, but certainly I think like he's trying to cast himself as this noble person trying to save social media when he is King Troll, like the richest man on earth, who is free to troll around wherever, whatever. Nate, what are you thinking about all this?
So my first thing I want to mention is that the entire time Devinder was speaking, I was just shaking my head because that's how I feel about this whole thing. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous that we had to go through this. You're right in that his initial offer did not seem genuine, but then he was kind of stuck.
He was stuck.
And had to, right. And you know, I don't know that like the courts had, I don't think it had progressed to a point where he was going to be forced to act, but I'm guessing he got the sense that it wasn't going to be worth it to fight it anymore because of stuff that might get revealed in discovery. And, you know, like you said, like there'd be like a breakup fee and like all this stuff. So he just said, well, screw it. I guess we're just going to go ahead. I find a little bit of satisfaction in the fact that he is being made to go forward with this at the original proposed value, because Twitter's lost a lot of value since this all came up. And so he's not getting that great of a deal. In regards to the letter, I said to someone, this seems like one of the more honest things that I've seen him say about this. And if he had said this at the beginning, I would maybe be a little less skeptical of him. But like you mentioned, he is King Troll. You know, why do you go out there and say you might fire 75% of the workforce? Only a few days later, be like, just kidding, I wasn't really going to do that. Like, no one knows if anything this guy says is legit. Like, there's no way to take him at his word.
I'm just done thinking about him at all, too. Like, he has also been around proposing solutions to the to Russia's war in Ukraine, and also like palling around with like Russian officials on Twitter too. Like, it is.
It's gross.
Very weird and gross, and not a fan of Elon Musk anymore, as you could tell from listening to the show, I don't know, for the past few years, folks. Yeah. But my other thing is that this feels like a serious loss. Like, it does feel like, for me, Twitter has always kind of been my favorite social network. I've made a lot of friends there. As a media person, it has been a great place to chat with other colleagues and meet new people. That's how, like, when I first started podcasting in 2008, like, Twitter was the way I was able to reach out to people I didn't know and be like, hey, do you want a guest on this movie podcast? And it worked. Like, we got a lot of folks at that point. And I don't know about the idea of a digital town square, but it does seem like, I always thought of Twitter as sort of like the feed of code in the Matrix, you know, like you kind of sit back and you just watch it flow. And like, you could see what's happening in the world, certainly in a very small pocket of the world, but you can kind of see what's happening in a lot of places. And I always appreciated that, maybe because I was kind of raised on the internet. Like, I became addicted to it at a very young age and was like, yeah, this is going to be a part of my life. Twitter was the best expression of that. I don't know what I'm going to do if this goes through, and if we start to see like crazy things happening because Musk doesn't believe in doing a lot of things like good moderation, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you summed up what can be good about Twitter very well there, very well, and what could be lost if it goes south. You know, as you mentioned, it is a relatively small pocket, right? So there's going to be the bias of the, you know, there's a bias because there's lots of people in the media on it. There's, you know, I think it's probably a lot of affluent people use it. But it also has been really good at like getting messages out for like, you know, underrepresented communities too. And yeah, I don't know what it looks like under Musk. And part of me feels like, well, is it really going to be that bad at first? Is it going to be the kind of thing where like, nothing really changes at first, and then like slowly you start to see his influence? Or is it the kind of thing where within a month or two it's going to be noticeably worse? And I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah.
What, like, because I feel like it's still a big enough ship that to totally change direction is going to take some time. And I also don't know if Musk is going to want that necessarily. You know, when he talks about digital town square, though, I can't help but roll my eyes, because is there a world town square? Like, the world is too big to have something called a town square at this point.
I feel like that
and
was
the internet is so big that you can't have an internet town square. Like, that doesn't, it just, the analogy doesn't track.
To
so
me,
I'm not
that
sure
was,
what that really means.
That's always been the magic of Twitter. Like, you could call it whatever you want, but certainly, yeah, there has never been a place on the planet to like unite everybody. I've always thought of Twitter as sort of like a great big cocktail party, you know? And it is, for years, for over a decade, it has been the most fun cocktail party of the internet, you know, where you just hang out and chat with people and you get...
I will say that's true if you're not a woman.
Yes, for sure.
Right.
Well, cocktail parties aren't great for women too.
No, I was going to but like, and you know this as a non-white person, I think that everything you're seeing on Twitter sounds great if you're a white guy. Mm-hmm. If you're a person of color or a woman or any
other. It's rough. It's rough.
Right. And even at its best of times when things were good, it was rough, and it's only gotten worse in the last 5 years.
It's gotten worse. I think the audience like has kind of pushed them to be more serious about like trying to protect people and giving you more controls over the audience.
Yes, that's finally happening.
Yeah, that's finally happening because people are speaking up. But I also think of other pockets of the internet right now, which are big social spaces. And I think of places like Reddit, you know, where I do occasionally visit Reddit. I do like some of the links that are shared there. But the community at Reddit has become this weird, curdled, like toxic thing, you know. It used to be really bad, and I feel like it's gotten better, but even when I go there and I try to see things, even when people write about like my podcast or something, it always feels like a very weird perspective. So I don't like being there. It's not a place I like hanging out. Twitter is a place I just liked to hang out for all of its faults, and it won't be after this. Certainly I will not be subscribing to Twitter Blue anymore. That's something I did do because I liked some of those features, and if Elon Musk is in charge, like, why do I need to pay him? Don't need to pay him for anything. Not.
And the Reddit thing is interesting, too, because I feel like even in communities where, like, there's a community for the game, The Last of Us, which you know I like very much. And when I was reviewing The Last of Us Part 1 for the PS5 a few months ago, the embargo was such that we could talk about that we were doing this. And the review is coming out in 2 weeks or whatever. And I went on the Reddit and said, hey, I'm reviewing The Last of Us Part 1.
Oh, no.
What do you want to know? Yeah. And I was like, I'll take all these, you know, take your questions into consideration when I'm writing the review. And a lot of people were like, you know, there's a lot of like good questions and friendly discussion and whatnot. And then there's people who'd be like, why the hell are you doing this? You just want karma points. You can't even talk about it yet anyway, so who cares? And I'm like, I mean, the level of insult just seemed to be so disproportionate to what I was doing. I was like, why do people get this upset about
people get upset about everything? I mean, even on Twitter, Garden Lady was the main character for a while, and that was a whole thing of somebody just saying like, hey, I like getting up and having coffee with my husband in the morning, and everybody freaked out. So that is a whole internet problem of people just not
definitely
I think centering themselves, you know,
having the appropriate context for a situation.
It's very weird. So we don't know what's going to happen, folks. It feels momentous, right? A lot can change tomorrow. And honestly, if Elon Musk does start doing mass layoffs and, you know, changing major features, the entire platform could be changed like very easily.
Look at how fast Tumblr kind of like went out of fashion, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It just became less cool. But also like if he lets Trump come back on, if he allows like the worst elements of Twitter that we've spent a long time trying to like get off the platform, if he just allows that for quote unquote, you know, open conversation between both sides, I'm out. I will quiet quit Twitter, basically. I don't know.
Same.
Maybe occasional post for work stuff, but I just can't use it. Hey, listeners, like I don't know if this is at all interesting to you, but I feel like as a person who has been on the internet for a very long time, I remember my first AOL chat rooms that I like hung out and talked about video games and anime with people. I spent a lot of time in like anime chat rooms, like just on the internet. Those were CGI chat rooms. I remember doing ICQ chat rooms with people, and college was all AIM. It was just all the AIM noise across.
Oh man, loved it.
Yeah, loved it. Like that's how we all communicated. Twitter, I think for the past, since 2008 for me at least, has been the way I communicated on the internet. So it's going to be really sad to see things change and potentially like go downhill. I don't know.
I was going to say one last point I want to make about that, the possible changes. I know a lot of people who, obviously you said you've used it a lot for your podcast and for your career. I know a lot of people who are freelancers and so forth who have like really used Twitter as like such an important networking resource,
absolutely,
a promotion platform, who are like actively concerned about their livelihood, like not just like the fun and the connection, but like, am I going to be as effective at doing my job without this?
For sure.
And like, that's an unfortunate thought.
I mean, for to be a freelancer, you have to try to get in touch with editors. You may not know them. You may not have their email addresses. Like, it's really hard to promote yourself. It's hard to also, unless you're doing TikTok dances or following the latest like trend, it's hard to get noticed on the internet. And Twitter always felt like a thing that it was a good platform to at least, you know, to talk about yourself, promote your work, share your work. It was more shareable and open than Facebook ever was. I still hate getting a Facebook link for anything because am I going to click on this? Is it going to ask me to log in? I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. Anyway, Twitter looks like it's going to be sold to Elon Musk. We will be following this. I'm sure Carissa Bell.
I'm sure there'll be more to say about this in a week, probably.
Absolutely. I'm sure our social media reporter, Carissa Bell, will also have a lot to say. So we will definitely bring her on at some point to chat about all this. Let's move on to what we've been working on. I mentioned the Surface Pro 9 with 5G. I don't really have much to add. That review is going up soon. Likely today. It should be on Engadget by the time you hear this podcast. I'm giving it the lowest score I've ever given a Surface because I'm calling it a beautiful lie. Because that's what feels like. And I talked to several people at Microsoft. I'm like, how the hell can you give one product an Intel chip and an ARM chip and expect people to understand the differences? And there was a lot of like just hand shrugging, a lot of just like, we'll see what happens. It feels outright irresponsible to me as somebody who has supported people in IT, somebody who's like still has to deal with a lot of computer help. We have people in my family. Sounds like a disaster in the making.
I'm looking forward to that review.
yeah. It's I just kind of channeled a lot of hatred at that point and for all the problems Surfaces still have. My overall tip there, probably don't buy the Surface Pro 9 with 5G. The Intel model will be a lot more interesting for sure. Nate, what else are you working on?
Yeah, so obviously I'm wrapping up our reviews of these two iPads. One of them should be live on Friday as this podcast goes out, and the other one should follow within a couple days. And then in fun, exciting news, I'm also reviewing God of War Ragnarok.
Oh, boy.
Which, so that review comes out, I believe, the first week of November. Mm-hmm. I might actually end up pushing it a little bit so I have more time to finish playing it because all I've been doing is playing with iPads. But my first impressions are that it's pretty dope so far, and I'm looking forward to digging into it.
You do love your high profile AAA PlayStation games, right? Like that
I
is
do,
your
yeah.
thing.
Horizon, yeah. God of War, Last of Us, mm-hmm. Third person action adventure games and good stories is my jam.
I did like the 2018 reboot, if it felt like we got to put some Dark Souls in our God of War. We got to mash this up somehow, and it felt
what's the Dark Souls influence?
I mean, the combat, straight up. Like I remember you were addicted to the combat. Like you were killing all the Valkyries, right? And those tough, impossible battles. Like that's all the way the combat was mapped to the shoulder buttons and everything. A lot of that is Dark Souls influence.
That's so interesting because I haven't played Dark Souls or Elden.
Wait, what?
Yeah, no, never.
What
played
are you
them.
Talking about, Nate?
And I don't usually go in for like crazy difficulty, but like getting the Valkyries was like a really addictive experience.
You should play some Elden Ring.
I think it honestly took me 8 hours to beat the final Valkyrie. I don't know. Again, it just got to a point where I put so much time and effort into it that I was like, I've got to see this through.
You got to finish it. I'm the sort of person where I'm like, oh, this is tough. I will try a couple of times. And I'm like, oh, I have other things to do in my life. If it's not critical to the game,
usually that's what I do. But for some reason, this one captivated me.
Okay. Okay.
The combat was that fun, I guess.
It was that fun. Is it? I know it's a lot of the same combat. You could only talk about the first 5 hours, I believe, up to this
point. Yeah, and I haven't even gotten that part, so I haven't got to the point where I'm going to see like where things really like break away from the previous game. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
I'm interested. They are talking about this being the end of the story, which makes me think they're just going to kill Kratos. Like this is going to be the end of Kratos, and his son will take over, and who knows what's going to happen.
I mean, we'll see future games starring his son, perhaps.
And in 10 years, the resurrection of Kratos or something. Right. Cool. Sounds fun. Looking forward to seeing more of that. Did you do a preview of God of War, Nate?
No, I haven't published anything about it yet.
Okay. I do know some of those went up. So keep an eye out for Nate's review of God of War. I'm sure it's going to be a fun time. Let's move on to our pop culture picks. I just wanted to quickly shout out a movie I talked about a couple of weeks ago, maybe even months ago, is Barbarian, one of the best horror movies that came out this year. Was a very big hit in theaters, a kind of a surprise hit because nobody expected it to be very good. Is now on HBO Max. So if you want to check out Barbarian, the movie about a woman who goes to an Airbnb and discovers things are a little weird, go check it out. I am a little disappointed. It's only... for some reason on HBO, it's only 1080p HD. So if you want to, this movie is good. I think you should blind buy it too. If you don't have HBO Max, on iTunes, it is 4K HDR. And I do think the Dolby Vision helps quite a bit because there's a lot of dark scenes in this movie. So anyway, either way you see it, I think it'll be good. I think Barbarian is one of the best movies of the year. So check it out. It's on HBO Max now. Nate, what's up with you?
How horror is it?
It's very horror. Like it's very much like it's kind of funny at times because it's actually by one of the members of the Whitest Kids You Know. And I think there was something really interesting about comedy directors going into horror. Like they kind of have similar vibes, sort of like horror directors going into superhero movies too, like that kind of good vibes that they can kind of carry over into different genres. It is you know, genuinely scary at times. It's kind of gross at times. It's not like torture porn horror. It is there's a monster type of thing and a lot of good tension, a lot of good twists. It's very good. I'm not gonna say anything else. Barbarian, right. Check it out. It's on HBO Max. What are you watching, Nate?
I've been watching Bad Sisters on Apple TV.
Oh, I've been too. Yeah, great.
Nice. Yeah, it's an Irish show that is both extremely funny and very dark. So you probably classify it as a dark comedy, right?
It is,
But the dark part of it is actually quite upsetting, I'll have to say. Like, it's about a family of five sisters, broadly speaking, the Bad Sisters. Mm-hmm. And one of them is just going through a really, like, terrible time with her husband. And I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say that. And it's just seeing how he treats her is just straight up upsetting.
That disgusting. Actor, Claes, I don't know how to pronounce the name properly, but Claes Bang, is one of the greatest, like, biggest assholes I've ever seen on television. Just like a bad dude. You want everything bad to happen to him, but it's kind of fascinating to see, like, how he, like, I don't know.
And the fact that they're able to mix that. Mm-hmm. The fact that you're able to mix a character like that with some funny stuff is impressive to me. Yep. And I haven't finished the season yet. I'm looking forward to wrapping up. I think I have like 3 episodes left. So I'm looking forward to seeing what happens.
I'd also recommend this to everybody. It's also stars Sharon Horgan. And Sharon Horgan, everything she's in, I'm just like, just watch it because.
Yeah, she's great, right?
She's great in everything. So Catastrophe, she was in BoJack Horseman. Yep. Catastrophe was the Amazon show she did with Rob Delaney, I believe. And also great, devastating show, but really like funny. Yeah. All right, folks, that's it for the show this week. Hopefully, Sherlyn's going to feel better. Hoping to see her back next week. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman, but I'll be editing this episode, so you can just send any complaints straight to me. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter. If you need Nate, where can we find you?
Yes, I'm on Twitter at Nate Ingram, at least for now.
For now. Oh yeah, I don't know.
Well, you know,
maybe Mastodon, maybe something. Claim all your Mastodon usernames. I think that you do have to claim.
I kind of want to make Tumblr happen again.
I want the old web to happen again, so maybe we'll dedicate a whole episode to that at some point. But I do miss the old web. I miss it so much. You can email us at podcast@engadget.com, leave us a review on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Thanks, folks. We're out.